earthquakes, hurricanes. Oh, we don't talk about hurricanes. Hurricanes, storms, floods, whatever. And we even see comparisons of military power or references to balance of power in crucial regions of the earth. In political campaigns, we have constant references to political power, or lack of it, of various groups. But let me remind you that far stronger than all these forms of power, stronger even than the immense energy harnessed and released by nuclear power or the forces of nature, is another greater power. It, in fact, is the power that took a dead man and, despite all the physical forces and all the spiritual forces which desperately tried to keep him dead, it took that dead man and brought him back to life. This very same power then took him through the very strongholds of those spiritual forces, despite their concerted attempts to keep him on earth, and it enthroned him in a position of authority and victory over them. It is, in fact, nothing less than the resurrection the resurrection power of God, which raised Yeshua from the dead, produced his ascension, and seated him to rule over the entire universe, both seen and unseen. Now, Rav Shaul talks about this power in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 19 and following, and that was part of our reading tonight, and we looked at it a couple weeks ago. In fact, he gets so excited, his discussion spills over into chapter 2, the opening verses. It's as if he says, this is behind the scenes, so to speak, in chapter 2, it's as if he says, next, you may see that power as it has been at work in yourselves. You also have been raised from the dead, for you were dead, he says. Not with a physical death, as was the death of Yeshua, but dead in your sins. It's as if that's how this paragraph in chapter 2 flows. He gushes on so much that you don't actually have a verb in chapter 2 until you reach verse 5. As he carries on the thoughts of chapter 1, the closing paragraph, and further explains this resurrection power and its implications for us. So what I'd like to do with you this evening is to take a look at this power as we see it in chapter 2. And as you see it in the outline that's part of the insert, we're going to look first at the reach of that resurrection power in the opening paragraph here. And we can see that it reached us when we were dead. It reached us when we were dead? What do you mean dead? Well, some of the translations read dead in transgressions and sins. So what's the meaning of that? Well, if you look up the Hebrew that would stand behind it, chatat, it has to do with missing the mark, missing the target, or as our translation here provides us, disobedience and wrongdoing. Now, he's not talking then about being dead physically, but just as certainly we are dead because of sin or wrongdoing or disobedience. So what does that mean? Well, among other things, it means it's a description of the condition of those who have no life beyond the life of this world, which is dominated by death and deadening stuff, and to some degree, some you might even describe as lords of death. It is what was described by the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 59, the opening couple verses. He says, God's ears are not so heavy, nor is his arm shortened so that he can't reach you. But he said, Isaiah says, but your sins, your wrongdoings, your shortcomings have erected a barrier between you and your God. It's similar to what God said to Adam and Eve. Disobedience will result in death. And the implication there was not that they dropped dead. No, it was that their relationship with God was deadened. For you were dead. Not with a physical death, as was the death of Yeshua, but you were dead because of your disobedience and wrongdoing. Now, this resurrection power reached us also when we were dominated verse 2, talks about following the ways of the world. Very interesting Greek term here. This was originally written in Greek. It builds on a Hebrew concept, the concept of walking. Now, there could have been, the rabbi could have used a different Greek word here than the one he used. Normally, you would have expected something that, a verb that related to behavior or conduct in relationship to a state. But instead, he uses this particular word for walking because he's building on the concept that we're very familiar with, the concept of halakha. And halakha ultimately refers to behavior with respect to and in response to certain guidelines, particularly in this case, those that come from God. So it's a term that indicates the regulation of our lives in accord with certain external influences or standards. Our moral conduct, in other words, is shaped by something external. Now, in the early days of our movement, back in the book of Acts, our movement was described as the way. The way, there it is again, halakha, the way you walk. You know, we utilize that very same concept as the Torah was walked among us, so to speak. And it says, what is it that the Lord your God expects of you? To fear him, to serve him, to love him. Here it is. To do what? Walk in all his ways. That's what is here that he's being described. He talks in terms of the ways of this world. This too builds on a very interesting Hebrew phrase, a rabbinic concept. In fact, it's olam hazeh. And it's a somewhat complex kind of concept. It refers to, how do I put this? Space and time. Both of those things. So it's the age of this world or the time of this world or whatever describes this particular world that we're in. But it's not just the world itself. It's the world in contrast to the coming time world. This Hebrew concept has to do, like I said, with space and with time, the world and the time to come. And so it's in contrast, this world in this particular case, with that coming time world. I keep thinking, every time I say that, I keep thinking about Doctor Who. It's in stark contrast with that coming time world and all it represents. In other words, God's reign through the Messiah, and as we've already described it, the Torah proceeding from Jerusalem. Now, some translations then talk in this particular verse about the kingdom of the air. The translation we read was slightly different. It's the evil spiritual kingdom or realm. But air, in that particular usage, indicates that which is for these people, that which is beyond the earth. In other words, beyond what can be seen. Not necessarily air spatially, but in this sense conceptually. And it was in fact regarded by Jewish people of that day, as well as others, that realm, so to speak, as being peopled by spirits, usually evil spirits. And you can read this in a number of the writings of the Second Temple period. And in that sense, then, the air is a parallel to the heavenlies. But it indicates something of proximity and influence as well. It's not just separated way out there. It is somehow integrated with what we can see. And then a character is described there, a ruler of this particular realm or sphere. Now, ancient Jewish understanding was such that as a result of what happened in the Garden of Eden, the world had become subject to the influence, often the very subtle influence, of these spirits. And the ruler of these spirits was, in fact, one called Hasatan, the usurper, or Satan. And so our text summarizes it for us then. Your former life was a death rather than a life. You shaped your conduct after the pattern of the present world, after the will of the power that dominates it, Satan and his unseen lackeys. And then we find, as we continue reading, that this resurrection power reached us when we were disobedient. and I use this term very carefully here. It describes, first of all, the source of that disobedience ultimately. Let me change that. I only use source in order to get something that alliterates itself here. But it's in the sense of inspiring force. Describes this spirit. Ultimately, it's saying HaSatan is behind all this. But please let me be very careful, because the rabbi here is very careful. Not in the sense of the devil made me do it, because he didn't. But in the sense of the inspiring force behind what goes on in many places around us. And then to further delineate what he's talking about, he uses a very specific verb yet again. It's a verb that it's the same verb that he used in chapter 1, verse 11, where it talks about God working out everything according to his plan. Same verb. So here we see something of an opponent working out things according to his plan, or trying to do. The point here is that there's a rivalry, there's a contention with God and with God's purposes. It's describing HaSatan's machinations. And that means for us that there's a battle going on. He's going to further interact with this battle in chapter 6, but that's a number of weeks down the road for us. I just reference it at this point. But the bottom line is this. Ultimately, we're on one side or the other, and we need to be aware of that. So the source or the inspiring force of this disobedience is mentioned there, but then the symptoms are mentioned as well. And he describes them as are gratifying certain cravings. Again, a striking term that's used here. It builds on the Hebrew concept, or the Hebrew word, lev. And as Dr. Patrice points out on numerous occasions, that does not mean heart as in the sense of the seat of your emotions, or I heart over you. It has to do with the whole of the person. It has to do with what's really, what the person, or who the person really is, what's deep inside. And again, some translations here talk about you did certain things by nature. Again, a bit of background here. In ourselves, now let me change that. He's talking about what's in ourselves. And in that case, it's not nature as bad, but it's usually used in the good sense. It simply means the natural constitution of a thing. What it is in and of itself, apart from anything outside of it. And so, unfortunately, this is misunderstood. It's not a reference to what is often called the sin nature, but it is, in fact, a reference to us as we would be left to ourselves, as we are as human beings, as our translation has here, natural desires. But unfortunately, as the text also indicates, sometimes those natural desires devolve into baser instincts. And so, he is the inspiring force of those who refuse obedience to God, the text says. We also lived in this fashion, following the dictates of our lower desires. Next, we move on to the results of resurrection power. We looked at the reach of resurrection power, now the results. He starts, first of all, describing a display of amazing compassion. He talks in terms of, depending on your translation, great love or immense love. He talks in terms of being rich in mercy or immense mercy. And then in verse 5, he talks about this graciousness or grace that was extended to us when we were, again, some translations, dead in transgressions. In other words, when we were, I almost said dead to him. That has other connotations. But dead toward him. In other words, unresponsive. And if against that background, this is truly a display of amazing compassion, truly amazing, a truly gracious rescue, as our translation reads. Then the next couple verses move on from the display of amazing compassion to the dynamic of an astounding comparison. And as we work through it, you'll find it is truly an astounding comparison. He talks about us being made alive, in stark contrast to being deadened before, or dead toward God. And when he talks about being made alive, he's talking now about life in relationship with God. He's talking about life beyond the life of this world, which ultimately is a dead end. He's talking about life in its fullness and dynamic and power. That's the implication of being made alive. By the way, this is where you now get that first verb. So this is the main point of his text, his discussion with us. And then he says, we've been raised and seated with. Now, often we don't make a whole lot of thing, a whole lot of, what should I say? Don't spend a whole lot of time with prepositions. But this is a striking preposition that's here. In fact, it's so striking a preposition that I did a whole master's thesis on it and its usage, which I won't bore you with. Raised and seated with is a powerful image or metaphor here. It has to do with identification. It has to do with our being linked with or connected to Yeshua. It has to do with union. It means joined to or having become part of Yeshua. All of this in some deeper way. And in this sense, then, it parallels what he had described in the previous chapter as he talks about verses 19 and following, the incredibly great power that's at work in us, that awesome might that he used when he raised Yeshua from the dead and enthroned him in the position of authority in the heavenly realms where he rules far above all power and authority and so forth. This preposition sets in motion a parallel in the very terms that are used. It means that in some sense we too have been raised and seated with him. It should give us a sense of the victory and authority that we get to share with him. It should result in confidence and not in fear as we face circumstances, as Matt indicated for us as he shared some thoughts on the parasha. And where we are located is in the heavenly realms, the text says, the rabbi tells us. And thereby he completes the parallel with verses 19 to 21 in chapter 1. We are literally seated with him in the heavenly realms, which means we're above the spirits as opposed to being under their influence as we were in verses 1 to 3. And then he points out that all of this takes place in Yeshua. Now, once again, we would have expected the word with here as in the previous text. But here it's a different preposition, and this preposition states the relationship in its completest form. What it's indicating for us as we are in Yeshua is that there is a total organic union. We, in effect, are an integral part of him. So Yeshua was dead. And in a true sense, then, we were too. And so we were truly made alive with him, raised and seated with him. This, by the way, although difficult sometimes to conceive, this is a divine action that was contemporary with Yeshua's resurrection and ascension. It's independent of human action, our action. What happened to him happened to us. Sort of like a bookmark in a book. What happens to the book happens to the bookmark. What he's saying here is that God's grace has lifted us into a new life and into a new world, into new realities with new resources, and even, in some sense, new authority. That means, if we grasp this even in the slightest sense, because we're now above those spirits, we don't have to be impacted or influenced by what's around us. We can rise above it because we are truly above it. And then as he concludes this section, he gives us some reasons for this resurrection power. And what might those reasons be? Well, he begins in verse 7. Reason number one is so that God could exhibit his grace. Different translations, again, use different words here. He talks about riches. He talks about grace. He talks about kindness. As our translation reminds us, it's measureless. It's rich. It's incomparable. It sounds very much like God described himself to Moses on the mountain. Exodus chapter 34. A God who overflows in graciousness, who abounds in loving kindness, who spills over in mercy and so forth. It's something that, in fact, as the rabbi tells us here, relates to the coming ages. Once again, a rabbinic concept, Olam Haba, in contrast to what we had earlier in verse 2. And that should remind us that this particular thing that's going on relates to forever stuff. It relates to the time of being under the reign of the Messiah. It relates to the time of the restoration of the universe. But he's already told us that in the first chapter. That's part of his plan. That plan that includes what is to come. But notice how he describes these riches, this measureless, rich, incomparable grace. He extends it to us. Against the context of chapter 1, it's a reminder that we are the pinnacle of his purpose. We are, in fact, his masterpiece. Some translations, again, here say, it's in Yeshua, better translated as we have it in the translation in front of us, through Yeshua. In other words, Yeshua was the dramatic demonstration of this grace. He was the conduit conveying that grace to us. Another reason for this resurrection power is so God could extend his gift. Two things here. First of all, the content of that gift. Content of that gift, as you look at verses 8 and 9, so often quoted but not often understood, the content of that gift is not faith. The content of that gift is what is called salvation, which then begs to be defined. So since it's begging for me to define it, I'll define it, at least as understood in that world. It has to do with rescue. It has to do with restoration. Sometimes it's called redemption. It has to do with liberation or emancipation. It has to do with the kind of stuff that the Jubilee year pictured during the time of Moses. When everything was, when property was restored to its former owners, when people were restored to their former status, when things were brought back to the way in which they should have been and were. And it also then has a, because that is a future-looking kind of concept, it is in fact a picture of the future and the future promises to Israel that relate very directly to stuff that takes place here on earth. The rabbis understood this kind of restoration and described it as Gan Eden, Garden of Eden. As it was in the beginning, so it is in fact restored. Now, this is found, salvation is found here in the verb form, with that word that you often have heard, but perhaps most people don't understand when they use it, saved. Not what you just did with half of your paycheck, but in the sense of how we describe salvation. But in the verb form, we find, look, I'm getting grammatical with you again, and so I need to take a drink to get through this. And I know it's Friday night, I know it's Shabbat, it shouldn't be grammatical, but this is important. There's a tense in the Greek that we don't, well, we sort of have. It's the perfect tense. It doesn't mean that the tense is perfect. It's not in the present, or what we would call the simple past. And in Greek, in other words, the way in which the rabbi was trying to communicate this, it's describing an action that has been completed, but that it's continuous and permanent in its implications. Catch that? It's already been done for us, but it's continuous and permanent in its implications. So that's the content of the gift, the condition surrounding it. Once again, there's that term grace. In other words, it's something that's totally undeserved and unmerited. The Hebrew has the term shin. Totally undeserved and unmerited. And that's what he's building on. And he says, this does not come from ourselves. It is of God. In other words, he's the source. As our translation has it, it is not of our own doing. And then just to make sure we got the point, he has put God in the position of emphasis in this particular text. And then when he uses the term gift, he's just re-emphasizing the nature of God's graciousness and God's initiative in reaching out to us. Some translations at this point say it's not of works. In other words, that which is described as works is not the source or the condition of this particular situation of salvation. It's not the result of our own efforts, as you have in front of you. In other words, and this is very important, it's not performance-based. And if it's not performance-based, that takes a lot of pressure off of us. Well, Rabbi, you said this gift is not faith, so what's the role of faith? Well, in this particular case, the role of faith is our response to that gift. And if it's a response, then it's a decision. It's a choice we get to make. It's the Hebrew term emunah. I know he didn't write, he wrote this in Greek, but he's working from the Hebrew term emunah. Emunah. Abraham was one who was characterized by this. And what did we learn when Abraham trusted God? What we learned is, in effect, as the term itself means, he grabbed hold of God's hand. It's sort of like being in the arms of a parent when you put yourself in the arms of when you used to put yourself in the arms of your parents. It has to do with trusting God. It has to do with trust and trusting, an ongoing kind of response. And then finally, we get to verse 10. Another of the reasons is so we could execute good works. I don't mean chop off their heads. I mean put them into practice. But note first that we are described as God's workmanship. In other words, we are who we are not because of who of ourselves, but because of what God does and God has done for us. The term that he uses here is an interesting term. It has to do with creation or crafting. We've been handcrafted. We've been created, as the text says, in Yeshua. Again, the construction is such that he's telling us, because we are in union with Yeshua, we have in fact become a new creation. He says that in another of his letters, 2 Corinthians 5. We've got a whole new life. We've got a fresh beginning. We've got new resources. And the point of it all is to do good works, as some translations have it for you. Again, a very important preposition here. It means with a view to. It's pointing to the result of a transaction. So if you want to rephrase this, this salvation that we've described is not of works, but unto works. It doesn't begin here, but it leads to here. It is, of course, the Jewish concept of mitzvot. And in this case, the mitzvot has become a 180-degree flip from the way in which we were living before in verses 2 and 3. Following the world's evil ways in a pathway, a walking of disobedience and wrongdoing. It's a complete flip. And notice, however, these mitzvot were prepared in advance. This, too, is part of God's purpose. The way in which we live, don't miss this, the way in which we live indicates that we have a part in God's purpose. The way in which we live is part of God's purpose. Our efforts, our activity, then, are significant. And they should result, as the rabbis of old remind us, in tikkun olam, in the repairing of the world as part of what we do. There was another rabbi who lived not long after the rabbi who wrote this. This rabbi was Yochanan ben Zakkai. And here's how he put it. If you've performed many mitzvot, or literally, you've done much Torah, if you've performed many mitzvot, do not think that you have any merit, that you're entitled to a reward. This is the purpose for which you have been created. Sound familiar? That's exactly what we read in the words of the rabbi that we have been reading. For God handcrafted us, verse 10, and in union with Messiah Yeshua, he created for us a life of doing the good he has planned for us. That leaves us with just one other thing to consider, and that's the responsibilities of resurrection power. Resurrection power, the greatest power in the universe, reached out to us, as the rabbi reminds us, when we were dead because of the way in which we lived. When we were dominated by forces or influences that shaped the world around us. When we were disobedient and therefore going away from God. So, what should our responsibility be in this case? It should be to thank God that he's done that. Resurrection in power resulted in, as we looked at it, a display of amazing compassion. God's outsized or oversized grace and love and mercy, as per Exodus 34. It also resulted in the dynamic of an astounding comparison, a connection. We've been made alive. We've been brought back from the dead. We've ascended and seated and been seated in parallel to and in union with Yeshua the Messiah. Our responsibility then is to live in the realization of this. Lives that reflect this particular reality. As we confidently and as we actively draw on these resources and live in light of these realities. There are reasons for the display of this resurrection power. Prime among them is, as we saw, so we could execute good works. As a new creation, doing our part in accomplishing God's purpose. In effect, to combine some Yiddish with some Hebrew, we should become mitzvah menschen, people who perform or who live, who behave in such a way. They can be described with the term mitzvot, doing the good stuff. Please understand as we approach this text that in effect, Rav Shaul began this discussion back in chapter 1, verse 18. Praying that we might know in our personal experience the mighty energy that is available to all followers of Yeshua the Messiah. He said it's the very power that raised and exalted Yeshua. In the same way it has raised and exalted us in and with him, because we can't be separated from him as a body can't be separated from its head, as he discussed last chapter. There are several results of God's actions in all this. It lifts us beyond the present world and its pressures, and it sets us in the heavenly realms. It lifts us above the control of the influences which dominate the course of the earth. It seats us where Yeshua is seated, above all powers that are or can be. It lifts us out of death, out of being deadened, and it makes us truly alive and alive with power. And it leaves us with the question, do our lives reflect the realities of being truly alive, no longer deadened? Do we, in fact, reflect the results of being joined to Yeshua and lifted up beyond this world and its control? Do we reflect Yeshua's victory over the influences around us, being lifted up above the forces and powers which dominate our world? Friends, we have supernatural resources and resurrection power at our fingertips. So, do we realize it and do we utilize it? Is the question that is left to us by the rabbi. And we take the next few minutes in silence to begin our response as we reflect on these things.